I'm Fully Batibo. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, marching closer to $100 a barrel. Oil prices have hit an eight-year high on U.S. warnings of a war in Ukraine. So will the prices keep going up? And how are consumers feeling the pain? Also this week, Russia and China signed a gas and oil deal as tension escalated over Ukraine. So why is President Vladimir Putin looking east? And could the energy pivot to Asia pose challenges for Europe? And a stock split in Silicon Valley, the move by Google's parent company Alphabet aims to make shares cheaper and more affordable for investors. But is it really a good buying opportunity? Thank you for joining us. The price of oil has hit its highest level since 2014, and that could raise the prices of almost everything. Consumers have already felt the pain at the petrol pump as talk of a Russian invasion of Ukraine grew louder. The price of Brent crude futures, the global benchmark, rose to above $96 per barrel last week, and it might become even more expensive. Now, the oil market is tight, and traders are worried the geopolitical tension over Ukraine could cause disruption to Moscow's fuel exports. Russia plays an important role in the global commodity markets. It's the world's number two producer of oil, second only to the United States. The nation exports about 5 billion barrels a day of crude, roughly 12% of global trade, and around 2.5 million barrels a day of petroleum products, about 10% of global trade. About 60% of Russia's oil exports go to Europe and another 30% to China. But other factors play an important role too. Demand for energy is soaring as coronavirus restrictions are being lifted while inventories are stretched thin. There's been pressure on the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies, including Russia, to increase supply. But the group known as OPEC Plus is failing to live up to its supply pledges. And the U.S. has released 50 million barrels of oil from its strategic reserves in an attempt to ease the pressure on consumers. While fears of a Russian invasion haven't just roiled the oil market, global stocks dropped too. The sell-off was sharpest in Europe, and Asian markets took a hit as well. Russia's main stock market has also been dragged down, and its currency, the ruble, was weaker against the U.S. dollar. European natural gas and power prices went up as tensions rose. Well, markets rallied and prices cooled off slightly after Russia said some troops near the Ukrainian border will return to their bases, but they remain volatile to every twist and turn in the Ukraine standoff. A lot to discuss with our guests. First, we go to Robin Mills, who's Chief Executive Officer of Kamar Energy. He's joining us from Dubai. Very good to have you with us on Counting the Cost. Everyone, Robin, seems to be worried about oil prices crossing the $100 mark. Do you see this happening?
I think it's, yes, it's very likely. Prices have been pretty close to that mark for several weeks now. They've gone over $95, $96, so we're getting very close to the 100. The market remains significantly tight, and you have the geopolitical concerns on top of that. Mm. So I think, indeed, without some significant reversal in the situation, it's very likely we will cross 100 in the near future.
Right. We'll talk about the geopolitical tensions in a bit. What other factors have been driving these prices up?
Well, primarily what we've been seeing is simply a very strong economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic. Economies reopening, travel restarting, and particularly a lot of industrial activity, so heavy energy consumption, and that has run into constrained supply. Supply, of course, collapsed during 2020, mm-hmm. and the OPEC Plus group was very successful in cutting back production to meet the lower demand. It has not been so successful in bringing that production back online.
Yeah, let's talk a bit more about OPEC Plus. What can it do? What will it do, you think?
Well, it's a bit tricky because you really have a situation now where in the OPEC Plus group, you have only two, three members maybe, which have significant spare capacity, which is Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and some in Iraq. So every time that they announce that they would increase production monthly by 400,000 barrels per day, which is their scheduled amount, In fact, the actual increase is 200, 150 or less, because many of the members actually physically can't increase production anymore. What could OPEC Plus do? Well, it could say we have to revise our targets, allow the members with spare capacity to produce more. Mm-hmm. But of course, the members who are running out of spare capacity resist that.
Yeah, but as you say, Saudi Arabia and the UAE have a lot of spare capacity. Do you think they'll be helping shore up production?
Well, they're producing at target. It's not a problem with them, but they can't and won't produce over their targets. They don't want to break the deal that they've put together with such difficulty. Now, later this year, by September, in principle, those production cuts should have been worked off. You know, then there's a room for another discussion about where targets should go. Perhaps Saudi Arabia, UAE, and a few others get allocated higher amounts.
Right.
But of course, September's a long way off.
Right, it is a long way off. Well, let's talk about what's happening now and those geopolitical tensions with Ukraine. What is at stake here? Do you see the prices cooling off, coming down a bit, if the tensions do ease in the coming days or coming weeks?
Well, the Ukraine issue has certainly put some pressure on oil prices. I think not that much, perhaps in a funny way, not as much as it should have been. I think the Russia-Ukraine situation, the worry has been much more about gas than about oil. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, if there was a serious conflict, you could see that could affect oil supplies. At the moment, I think it's only adding a few dollars per barrel to the price. Right. I mean, certainly if the situation relaxes, then that will take off those few dollars, yes.
And Robin, there's also the Iran nuclear deal. Markets are keeping a close eye on this deal. How critical is it to oil traders? Would it affect prices?
Yes, it's pretty important. It's not a complete game changer, but if there was a deal, Iran might over the next 6 to 9 months bring back 1 million barrels per day or so of its production. It'd be able to sell freely to other consumers other than China, which is its only market at the moment. That might drop the oil price by $6 to $8 per barrel at a guess. So it certainly makes a difference, but it's not a complete game changer.
All right. Robin Mills, Chief Executive of Khamar Energy. Thank you very much for the moment. We'll be talking to you a bit more in just a few minutes.
Thank you.
But what does all that mean for consumers and the wider economy? To discuss this, I'm joined by our second guest, Tim Harkett, who's professor and chief economist at the Institute for Public Policy and Governance at the University of Technology, Sydney. Tim, thank you so much for being on Counting the Cost. So high prices, we know, affect consumers. What is the impact on everyday life?
Well, of course, the oil price being the highest it's been since 2014, when they had the issue in the Crimea, means that, you know, petrol at the barrels is going to be a lot higher. We've already noticed that here in Australia, even though we produce petrol ourselves. So, you know, it's going to directly affect people filling up their car. Mm-hmm.
What about the global economy? What impact will it have on growth? Does any country at this stage risk or face a threat of recession-like conditions as a result of these high oil prices?
Well, not yet. Mm-hmm. But what's important is that Russia itself, you know, is a major producer of oil, natural gas, wheat, palladium, copper, nickel. You know, itself would be a major supply shock from Russia. That would have a big impact on the global economy. Mm-hmm. Then there would be, of course, the reaction to the higher oil prices that you mentioned in your preface. So a supply shock from Russia, and then any impact you'd have from high oil prices, given that Russia is a major producer and exporter of oil globally in its own right.
Right. And what about the impact on government policies, Tim, to bring down, you know, the cost of living?
Well, ultimately, if you're an oil producer, a high oil price means that you'll have a huge boost to your revenue. So a lot of the more fuel-rich nations will find they've got more money to pump prime into the economy, so that could be of benefit. Mm-hmm. But the economies that are very dependent on oil, on imports, countries that need energy security like South Korea and Japan, it could be quite difficult.
Now, what about emerging markets? How are they going to benefit from this rise in prices?
Well, the emerging markets that oil producers, petroleum producers, yes, I'd say they would. But the ones that are importing or competing or don't have reserves be quite tough on emerging markets. And what's important too, I think, is the reliance that Germany has mm-hmm. on natural gas from Russia, if you take the European Union.
Speaking of Russia, do you see Russia benefiting from the increase in prices? Could that help it perhaps soften the impact of sanctions, if there were sanctions?
Well, I think it would help in the short term, but ultimately would probably hurt Russia the most, if not the Ukraine. They may have sanctions imposed, but it would actually cause supply-side difficulties, basically, as they have to finance the war. So I think it would be very, very bad for Russia and very bad, especially for the Ukraine, and probably a risk that might be economically too high.
Interesting. Thank you so much, Tim, for talking to us and giving us your views on this. Tim Harkett, Professor and Chief Economist at the Institute for Public Policy and Governance at the University of Technology, Sydney. We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you always.
Now, the crisis in Ukraine has pushed Russia closer to its giant neighbour, China. Presidents Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping announced a friendship with no forbidden areas of cooperation as they met at the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics. And energy is at the heart of cooperation between the two countries. Putin wants to diversify supplies away from Europe. His nation is the largest gas supplier to the continent. Russia and China signed gas and oil deals valued at an estimated $117.5 billion. Rosneft, Russia's largest oil producer, signed a 10-year deal with China's CNPC to supply 100 million tons of oil through Kazakhstan. And Gazprom agreed to ship 10 billion cubic meters of gas a year through a new pipeline, increasing supplies to China to 48 billion cubic meters. Putin's visit to Beijing was compared to his May 2014 trip when he signed a deal to deliver gas to China as tensions were high over Moscow's annexation of Crimea. Now, Russia is China's third largest gas supplier and delivers it mainly through the Power of Siberia pipeline. The 3,000-kilometer pipeline began pumping supplies in 2019 and links East Siberian fields to northeast China. And Russia plans to build the Power of Siberia 2, which would double gas exports from Russia to China, crossing through Mongolia. The pipeline connects China with the same gas fields that supply Europe and would put the continent in competition with Beijing. China also imported almost $3 billion worth of liquefied natural gas from Russia last year and invests in Russia's Yamal LNG and Arctic LNG 2 projects. Russia is China's second biggest oil supplier after Saudi Arabia, and about 40% of supplies flow through the East Siberia Pacific pipeline that was financed by Chinese loans. And the economic ties go beyond the energy supply. Russia and China's bilateral trade hit a record annual high of more than $146 billion in 2021. That's far higher than Moscow's overall trade with the United States, but still less than with the EU. Russia's trade with the bloc reached more than $220 billion in 2021, almost 1.5 times the size of Russian-Chinese trade. Well, back to Robin Mills, Chief Executive Officer of Qamar Energy in Dubai. Robin, what do you make of this deal? Is this a sign that Beijing is willing to support Russia's economy against possible sanctions from the West?
I see it in a more limited way than this. You know, Chinese gas demand has been growing very strongly. China needs to secure new supplies. Liquefied natural gas prices at the moment that are high. The market's quite tight. So this is something of a challenge for China. And this is a more limited deal than the very grand plans. This is gas coming from an offshore island in Russia. It's not connected to the rest of the Russian system. So this is gas that doesn't really have a home otherwise. It's quite a nice deal for China. They get access to gas, but without fundamentally changing the relationship with Russia yet.
Right.
Russia has always been pushing for a much grander deal, and you know we have to see if that will come.
Right. You say a limited deal, but the two countries say it's a mutually beneficial energy partnership. How? How important is Russia in securing China's energy security?
Well, Russia is very important as a gas exporter and an oil exporter, but particularly as a gas exporter to China. Mm-hmm. China doesn't want to be solely reliant on liquefied natural gas coming over the sea, which is maybe vulnerable to interruption. It wants onshore land-based routes, both from Central Asia and from Russia, to bring in gas as well. But I think China has always been successful in firstly, in leveraging the relationship quite well and getting good prices from the Russians. And secondly, never being too dependent and never giving into these grand schemes that the Russians have. Yes, they talk about a comprehensive energy partnership. Of course, the countries work closely, but it's not yet the kind of grand alliance in energy that the Russians might seem to be discussing.
So you would say that Beijing has the upper hand in this energy partnership with Moscow?
Yes, I think very much so. I mean, Russia has really nowhere else to turn. It has the European market, of course, which has its geopolitical and environmental complexities right now. And then it has the Chinese market, which is of course, big, fast-growing, but which is very remote from the main sources of Russian gas production.
Right.
That's one reason for this deal. This gas supply is coming from one of the few fields which is relatively close to China.
All right. Before we talk about what impact there'll be on the European gas market, I want to find out more about Russia. You know, China's demand for gas is expected to increase as it moves away from coal. Do you think this will make it a more lucrative market than Europe for the Russians?
I think the prices that China is paying, it seems from what we can tell that they are actually significantly below what the Europeans pay, and particularly when we include the long transport distances from the main gas-producing areas in Russia, so that means expensive pipelines. That have to be financed by the Russian side. Mm-hmm. And, of course, gas in China, yes, China's trying to move away from coal, but still, coal is cheap, so gas has to be not too expensive to be able to compete.
So price is really key. Now, how will this energy deal affect European gas supplies, you think, especially as Russia is in talks with China over the power of Siberia 2 gas supplies?
So at the moment, this deal, it's connecting an isolated field to China, so it doesn't make any difference to the European market. As you mentioned, the Paris-Siberia 2 pipeline is the real game changer because that would connect the West Siberian fields, which supply Europe, to China, and then Russia would have the ability to switch gas from Europe to China, depending on the price, depending on the politics. Now, that would be the game changer. And so far, the Chinese have held off on doing that. Perhaps they don't want to compete too openly with the Europeans. Perhaps they don't want to be exposed to higher prices. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, the Paris-Siberia Pipeline 2 has not yet gone through. But that's the thing that would really change the nature of this game.
Right. And then, Robin, there's the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, and there's been quite a lot of pressure in Europe and the US to block this project. Can Germany, which is, you know, at the helm of this Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline project, can Germany afford dismissing the project altogether? And how about Russia? The project brings money to its coffers, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's very problematic. I mean, look, in principle, Russia could continue sending gas through Ukraine. That route is still there, and that would be sufficient to meet its commitments. That would be sufficient to supply Germany through those routes, which have been used, of course, for decades. Mm-hmm. But Russia has had a policy of trying to bypass Ukraine. Germany has so far been prepared to go along with that. Now, the current situation may change that. If Germany doesn't approve of the pipeline, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline doesn't approve its operation, if there are sanctions on it, then the two sides will have to think again. You know, is Russia prepared to return to using a lot more Ukrainian transit? Would that mean severe shortages in Germany and other parts of Europe? Mm.
And Robin, finally, coming back to the Russia-China economic ties, how big of a role does energy play in these ties between the two countries? And what are the other areas of cooperation between them?
Well, the energy side is really crucial. I mean, the energy supply is from Russia to China. And that's primarily gas, but oil is important too. So that's really the key supply from Russia to China, plus various kind of minerals. This makes it a bit of a one-sided relationship because, of course, in the other direction go Chinese manufactured goods. So I think the Russians have always been somewhat wary of just becoming a kind of a junior resource partner to China. But that is the situation that they're in at the moment. So it's a bit of, I think, for a Russian point of view, a bit of an unbalanced trading relationship. But unfortunately, that's for them is the resources that they have to sell to China at the moment.
Robin Mills, thank you very much for talking to us about this. Thank you for your insight. Robin Mills is Chief Executive of Qamar Energy in Dubai. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Now, investing in stock markets can be a very profitable business, but many people don't have thousands of dollars on hand to buy them. While Google's parent company, Alphabet, says it wants to make its stocks cheaper for investors, the company has announced a 24-1 stock split, giving shareholders 19 more shares for every one they own. Now, this effectively means the cost of a single share has dropped from around $3,000 to less than a couple of hundred. The company has published a massive earnings report with a revenue growth of 32% over the year that has sent the stock up 7.5% earlier this month. Alphabet's recent decision comes almost 2 years after Apple split its stock, reviving a practice that almost disappeared from U.S. markets. Alphabet and Apple are among the few technology companies that have seen their market capitalization stretch into trillions of dollars. But Facebook is in decline for the first time in its history. Its parent company, Metaverse, has said the social media platform lost users for the first time since it was established 18 years ago, falling by around 500,000 users in the last 3 months of 2021. Meta's stock price plunged more than 26% earlier this month, wiping out more than $200 billion in its market value. Now let's find out more about how stock splits affect investors. Joining me is Neil Wilson, who's chief markets analyst at markets.com, joining us from London. Neil, very good to have you with us on Counting the Cost. So why did Alphabet split its stocks? Is it just about attracting more investors?
Yeah, there's several reasons why a company might decide to carry out a stock split. I think one of the main ones, obviously, is to attract more retail investors. It becomes pretty unaffordable when the stock is worth $3,000, and by splitting it, you reduce obviously the value of each individual stock, and existing shareholders obviously are unaffected in terms of their holdings overall. You can, of course, there's been a lot of retail interest in stock markets generally in the last couple of years. We've seen a big uptick in retail activity, and whilst there is the option of owning companies like Alphabet via fractional shares, it still remains more appealing to own, you know, an individual, a whole share outright. So that's one potential reason. Just opens up a bit more potential investor base. But also you can look to things like improved liquidity, because you increase the number of shares, so you can improve the liquidity of the shares. And also, Alphabet could have one eye, or at least half an eye, on Dow inclusion, so be included in the Dow index. And when you cut the value of each individual stock from $3,000 to $150, you become much more in the range that the Dow could be looking to include you.
So is it a good buying opportunity? Because we saw companies like Tesla and Apple see their share prices surge after the stock splits in 2020. Is it a good buying opportunity?
Well, the thing is, in theory, it shouldn't be. It should make no difference whatsoever to the actual share price. But, of course, if you are increasing the number of potential shareholders, then that increases the overall demand. So it could be potentially a good time to buy. I think, you know, there's a lot of retail frenzy around some of these stocks. So I think Apple and Tesla fit into that category. Mm. I'm not quite sure if Alphabet quite fits into that category, but certainly... we have seen the stock go up in value because of those examples of Tesla and Apple. We've seen the stocks go up in value because of the stock split. Yeah. And therefore, you could see potentially institutional investors, hedge funds, front-running some of that movement already. Right. So it's a bit of a tricky one to call. I'd say that your best bet is to stick to the theory that it should make no difference at all.
Now, interestingly, the practice had disappeared in the US, all but disappeared in the US. Why is it back now, Neil? Is it related to the Fed's decision, you think, to increase interest rates?
Well, I think really it's probably a sign that a lot of these companies... you know, they've been doing very well. We've seen a rapid acceleration in stock prices over the last few years. So companies that were trading, you know, it wasn't that long ago that Apple was we made a big song and dance about the fact that Apple had become a $1 trillion company. It's now a $3 trillion company. That's a huge capital appreciation. And therefore, the stock price has gone up massively. And there's a number of these companies where, you know, they were trading in the sort of couple hundred dollar region not that long ago, and suddenly they're into thousands of dollars. And I think it's partly the fact that you've just seen this big increase, and companies don't like their stock to be to look too expensive. So that having the stocks that helps that.
Let's talk about Facebook's woes now, Neil. I mean, the number of users down. Why are people increasingly leaving Facebook? Is it about, you know, younger people not being interested in it, or are there other factors at play here?
Yeah, I think younger people are just moving on to the next big thing. I think, unfortunately for Facebook, it's in that camp of companies, of brands, where you're always trying to appeal to the next big thing. And people have moved on. A lot of young people have moved on to things like TikTok. There's generally, I think, a lot more competition for eyeballs these days with streaming services as well. You look at Netflix, talks about TikTok as competition. So you could say that Facebook is in competition with Netflix. There's a lot of things going on here.
Well, what about Facebook's troubles? I mean, you know, the use of private user data and accusations of Facebook being a breeding ground for hate speech. How did that affect user numbers?
Yeah, I think that's definitely turned people off. I think there's a general a general sense that Facebook's no longer necessarily the good guy. I think it pushed people who might have been stickier with Facebook into other platforms, or seen people ditch the platform altogether. And I think you've just sort of seen it hit a kind of saturation point globally as well.
Neil Wilson, thank you very much for talking to us. Neil Wilson is Chief Markets Analyst at Markets.com.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at FullybaAJE, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. And that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Fuliba Thibault. From me and the whole team here in Doha, thank you for watching. The news on Al Jazeera is next.